It's time for conversations about our food and how it's grown on Farm to Table Talk with your host, Roger Wasson.
Well, some people have heard of BPA. Some people are concerned about BPA. Some people are just starting to hear about BPA because they're going to stores and they're seeing packages that sometimes are saying contains no BPA, and they walk away scratching their head and say, well, what is that? And should I really worry? Well, we're going to try to answer some of those questions in this podcast conversation. And I have a guest who has been spending a lot of time on this and looking at the science. He does represent the industry on these issues, and I'll let him explain that and explain what's happened and what this is. What is BPA? So I want to welcome Steve Henches. And Steve is the executive director of the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group at the American Chemistry Council. Boy, that's a mouthful, Steve. And also, you're with an organization. I'm going to ask you to explain the organization, too, and how you manage to be objective about all these various issues that your organization gets involved with. So, Steve, welcome to this podcast.
Thank you, Roger. I'm happy to join you today.
Well, Steve, let's start off with the fact that the Chemistry Council, who are members of the Chemistry Council? You're in Washington, D.C.,
That's correct. So ACC, the American Chemistry Council, is a trade association or an industry association, and we represent pretty much the larger chemical manufacturers in the U.S. So a lot of the names that you've heard about, Dow, DuPont, ExxonMobil Chemical, and you know a lot of large companies like that, but many other companies that maybe aren't quite as big. But really, we represent the chemical industry in the U.S.
I think that could be a challenge. More than ever, there are people that are speaking out that are just worried about chemicals in general. We're going to talk about a chemical in specific here, but how do you deal with people that are just skeptical and say, okay, well, you're representing the industry, so we know you're going to think that all chemicals are good, and how can we count on you being objective and fair?
Well, certainly we understand that there are other voices out there. We're not the only one. We do have our views on chemicals, but we know that that's not the only voice. We do try to focus on science, that our views tend to be based on the best science available. So we try to be as objective as we can, focusing on the facts, not just opinions.
Well, let's get to the facts about BPA. Could you explain, let's first explain to somebody that has never heard of it, and they don't even know what the acronym means. So could you explain what BPA is?
I can. You're right that BPA is an acronym, and the longer name is bisphenol A, and there's actually even a longer complete chemical name, but almost everybody goes by BPA or bisphenol A. What it is a synthetic chemical that is primarily used as a raw material or an intermediate, or in chemistry terms we call it a monomer, to make other materials. And these are materials that we use every day. We receive great benefit from those materials that are made from BPA. But as consumers, we actually contact very little BPA itself in our daily life.
How do you make BPA? And so I don't want to take a chemistry class here, but to actually produce this product, the BPA, what are the inputs? What's the raw material that might go into creating BPA?
Well, I can't avoid a little bit of a chemistry lesson here, but if we go back upstream, we're going back into the petrochemical industry, and the immediate precursors to bisphenol A, or BPA, are two chemicals, phenol, a very common chemical produced in large quantities, and a second chemical called acetone. Those two are combined in a chemical reaction that makes BPA.
Now, does it come from some sort of fossil fuels?
Yes, ultimately, if you trace it back a couple more steps from phenol and acetone, you go back upstream a little bit, you'll ultimately find yourself with crude oil. So it does come from oil and through the petrochemical industry.
And then what are all the different types of uses for BPA?
It's got primarily two uses. There are, I suppose, are quite a few smaller ones, but almost the large majority, probably 95% of it, is used to make two materials that we use every day. One of those is polycarbonate plastic. That's actually the biggest one. Probably 70% of all BPA is used to make polycarbonate. And that's a material, you may not know the name or even recognize it, but it has a unique set of attributes. It's very highly shatter resistant. It has good optical clarity. And it's lightweight, and those attributes make it almost invaluable in a wide range of consumer and industrial applications. Also makes it difficult to replace with anything else that's comparable in terms of safety, functionality, and cost effectiveness. And to give you a couple examples, let's say iconic examples where you can easily recognize it, think about automobile headlamp lenses and CDs and DVDs. Those are made from polycarbonate plastic, so they've got that shatter resistance, the clarity, and the lightweight. You see polycarbonate in many product sectors, products that we use every day, not only automotive, but electronics, building and construction, medical devices, and many others. So that's the biggest use. The second biggest one that accounts for maybe 25% of BPA is a material known as epoxy resin. So they're quite different materials, but they also have their own unique set of attributes. They are very tough, durable materials. Have good chemical resistance and good adhesion, and because of those attributes, you'll find them being epoxy resins in completely different kinds of applications compared to polycarbonate, very commonly used as protective coatings, for example, on metal surfaces, and in composites. And again, to give you a couple examples that you can maybe visualize a little better, epoxy resins have been widely used as a protective coating in many food and beverage cans, and you'll find them in composites used to make things like wind energy blades and aircraft bodies.
When you're saying for liners of cans and bottles and so forth, why is that even necessary? Why do you need to have something other than, I don't know, just glass or plastic? Or why has this particular kind of epoxy been necessary to be inside in these bottles and containers?
Well, you could say that foods and beverages are in a sense chemically reactive. Beverages can be acidic. A lot of foods can be acidic, and so they can react with a metal can. And you don't want that to happen because you don't want to contaminate a food or a beverage with metals that come from corrosion, really, of the metal can. And you certainly don't want breakthrough of the metal, for example, at a seam where you might get microbiological contamination. So really the coatings are used to help protect the safety and integrity of the contents. They prevent the food or beverage from contacting the raw metal of the can. So it's really an inert liner that prevents that interaction and therefore helps protect the safety and integrity of the contents.
Now, were there cans before there were liners like this, though?
I suppose there were some canned products really go back into the 1800s, I think, and certainly epoxy resins were not around then. But I think we can be sure that canned products back in those days would not have had the shelf life. They wouldn't have had the safety that we have today. We know we can be quite confident that canned foods today are safe. We know that they are very well protected.
So if I buy a case of soda pop or LaCroix or anything like that, is it likely to have a BPA lining?
My understanding is that it almost certainly will have a lining, and right now there's a very good chance that lining will be made from an epoxy resin made from BPA.
Now, would that apply to pretty much all canned goods?
Not all. There are other coatings that are used, other linings that are used, different chemistries are used. So it's not all epoxy resin, but historically, a large proportion of canned foods and beverages do include an epoxy resin coating. Something we have to keep in mind, though, is although the coating is made from BPA, there's very little BPA itself left in those coatings, very little that could get into the food or beverage.
Now, there's been controversy about BPA, and could you explain where that started? When did there start being issues about BPA?
BPA itself has been around for probably 60 years or more, but the controversy didn't really start until, let's say, 15 or 20 years ago, and BPA has been controversial since that time. based on claims that it is a so-called endocrine disruptor. And what that means is something that could interfere with normal endocrine functions in our bodies and cause a variety of health effects. So that's the controversy. Now, there's never really been a consensus on that view. Scientists around the world have been conducting quite a bit of research. They've been fascinated by BPA, conducted many hundreds, even thousands of studies on BPA. But even so, there's never really been a consensus that BPA causes any harm. But because of the new scientific information, regulators around the world, for example, FDA here in the U.S., have carefully evaluated the safety of BPA. And even legislators have been attracted to the controversy. Some of them have taken an interest. So it's been around for a while based on claims that BPA causes health effects, but there really has never been a consensus that BPA causes anything.
What's an example of some other products that have been claimed to be endocrine disruptors, or maybe some that even been proven? Or I'm maybe getting off the BPA track, but is there anything you can think of that people could relate to this endocrine disruptor sort of conversations?
Well, a few things. There are some people would say that there are hundreds or thousands of chemicals that are endocrine disruptors. I don't know if that's really true or not, but some of the things, there are certain things to think about that are very important. For example, some of them are synthetic chemicals, phthalates or other kinds of chemicals that are used in many, many consumer products. But other things to keep in mind are natural products in foods. For example, soy products contain chemicals that are endocrine active, and some people would call them endocrine disruptors. And even in our body, we all have natural hormones that are endocrine active, for example, estrogen and other things like that. And in the pharmaceutical world, for example, birth control pills contain an active ingredient, ethinyl estradiol, which is very potent estrogen. So estrogen active compounds are all over the place. They're in our bodies, they're in drugs that we use, they're in foods that we eat, and some of them are synthetic chemicals as well.
So the cumulative effect of endocrine disruptors, if there's would be what? I mean, when people are saying that the health effects, I'm not talking about specifically BPA, but just as a general class, what are some examples of the outcomes that people would be the most worried about of endocrine disruption?
Perhaps two of the areas that tend to come up a lot are effects on reproduction, our ability to reproduce, and then also developmental effects. Once we reproduce, do our offspring develop correctly? So that's one very, very big area. Lots of different specific health effects in there. And then the other big area that tends to come up is cancer. And those are things. All of those things are things that we care about. That's why it's a controversial area. It's important.
Mm-hmm. So when the issue started with BPA, did it have something to do with baby bottles initially?
It did, in that some years ago, baby bottles were not entirely, but the majority of them were made from polycarbonate plastic. And again, think back to the attributes. It's a great material. It's highly shatter resistant, which is something you really want when the product is going to be in the hands of an infant. It's clear, so you can see what's inside, and it's lightweight. So polycarbonate was very widely used. Polycarbonate is made from BPA. So very trace levels, very small levels of BPA could leach into the contents of the bottle. And about 20 years ago, we started seeing research suggesting that maybe BPA could cause some health effects of the type that we just discussed. And so that led to a lot of focus on polycarbonate baby bottles.
Do you have a position or do you have a policy of the organization as far as BPA is concerned?
Well, we have a position for sure. And again, what I do is I represent the leading global manufacturers of BPA and polycarbonate plastic. And what we've done is we recognize that the issue is fundamentally one that is science-based. And so we've taken a very active role in trying to resolve that controversy by sponsoring quite a bit of scientific research. Really, over the last 15 or 20 years, we've been very active in sponsoring research, trying to address any open scientific questions. Based on all scientific information that's available, We believe the safety of BPA is as it is used today in polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. We believe that safety is well supported. We're very confident of that.
And who regulates BPA?
It's in the U.S. It is regulated both by FDA and also by EPA. FDA is really the more important one because FDA regulates all things that contact food. So for polycarbonate and plastic, and whether it's a baby bottle or something else, and epoxy resins, for example, in the form of food can linings, FDA regulates those products.
What's the status of the regulation? Do they have any regulations that are pending, or does FDA have studies underway?
There's a lot to talk about there. So FDA's regulation, their interest in BPA is entirely focused on safety. When they regulate a food contact product, they don't consider cost-benefit relationships or anything like that at all. It's entirely based on safety. And as long as there has been controversy about BPA, so 15 or 20 years, FDA has played a very active role in evaluating all of that new scientific information as it is developed, many hundreds and even thousands of studies that have been published. And based on the science, just on the science, nothing else, FDA's view on the safety of BPA is very clear. It's concisely captured in a Q&A that you'll find on FDA's website. It's a very short Q&A. It simply says, is BPA safe? And of course, that's the question we're all interested in. FDA provides a very simple, very straightforward answer. They simply say, yes. Of course, there's extensive scientific information also available on their website to substantiate their view, but their view is unambiguous. That's what they have to say about it. They believe BPA is safe in food contact applications.
The administration just recently changed. There are still appointees being named. Do you anticipate any differences in their approach to issues such as BPA as new appointees start getting involved at the Food and Drug Administration?
We don't anticipate any, and the reason is that FDA's views on BPA have really always been based on science, and we continue anticipate that will continue to be the case. And so we don't expect any change in there, that any change in FDA's leadership as a result of the new administration will result in a change in their policy on BPA. FDA is a science-based organization, as they should be. Their views on BPA have been based on science. We don't really see that changing.
Well, one thing I wonder about, too, and I think other people wonder about, is that we are more and more dependent on industries themselves doing the research. And in large part, I think it's because there hasn't been the funds available for as much research as maybe had been done in the past. At least that's the impression I have, that the burden of research is passed more and more to the industry that's involved, which raises another issue because some people are skeptical and saying, well, gee, if you do the research, who would expect there to be any bad results? I invite you to respond to that, but even the broader question is, I mean, how would you kind of sum up the state of the science on BPA right now?
Well, again, I think you asked a few questions there, so I'll with regard to our approach, you might say it's a burden on industry. I think we view it more as an obligation. We have to know if our products are safe. And in the case of BPA, because of the controversy, we have been active in the scientific arena for a long time, 15 or 20 years, trying to resolve the controversy with research that we sponsor. But we're not the only voice out there. And in particular, in the case of BPA, FDA is perhaps the more important voice right now. And what's happened is that over the last 6 or 8 years, FDA has invested millions of dollars in scientific research on BPA conducted by FDA scientists in FDA's own labs. And what they set out to do 6 or 8 or 9 years ago is to answer what they believe are the key scientific questions and to resolve uncertainties about the safety of BPA. Again, FDA is very safety-focused. That's what they care about. That's what we care about, too. And this turns out to be what I would say is a remarkable research program, including most recently what is probably almost certainly the largest study ever conducted on BPA. So far, if you look at all of that research together, all of those results together, they strongly support the safety of BPA. And We anticipate, though, that, well, we know that FDA is not done, and we anticipate that FDA will release the results from one final study by the end of this year. We hope it's by the end of this year. And with those results, we expect that FDA will have met its goal of answering the key questions about the safety of BPA and resolving uncertainty about safety. So we're very much looking forward to those results. But so far, results that they've produced have been quite impressive, and they do collectively very strongly support safety of BPA. As has been, as you see in their opinion, is BPA safe? They say yes. That's based on science.
You know, when you have an issue like this that would have an effect on human health, it's tricky to have these kind of studies involving people. I would imagine there are a lot of animal studies and looking at data and maybe epidemiological studies of populations and what their consumption trends are and so forth. But do these studies include any clinical trials with humans engaged and some that are consuming more than others and that sort of thing?
Yes. Much of the research on BPA is done on laboratory animals. That's the traditional way you would do research. There are certain things you can't do on people. But there are studies that can be done with actual human volunteers, and in the case of BPA, have been done. So a couple of things that involve humans are measurement of how much we're actually exposed to. That's kind of easy to do. But from that research, we know that people are only exposed to very low levels of BPA. More importantly with human studies, though, is we know that when people are exposed to BPA, we're very good at processing BPA and quickly eliminating it from the body. And we know that from several studies on human volunteers where the volunteers are given measured doses of BPA, and then the researchers monitor where it goes in the body, what happens to it, where it comes out, and how quickly it comes out. That's very important research done with human volunteers.
So with that sort of the progress in the research, is that something that somebody was particularly interested in if they wanted to, you know, go on and do a search of Google Science or something like that? They can see abstracts about these studies?
You sure can. It's a bit overwhelming because of the number of studies, but you can search, for example, there is a online biomedical literature database operated by NIH. It's called PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, and you can just search for research. But it is overwhelming. You're going to find thousands of studies on BPA, so it's not so easy to really distill out of that what's important and what do we know from it. So one of the things we do is we try to really distill that down into information that's more usable on our website, which is factsaboutbpa.org. So you can find some information there. But if you really want all the details, it's going to be a lot of work because there's an awful lot of research out there. Another way to find it would be, for example, to go to FDA's website, and they'll also distill it down specifically in terms of safety, which is what they care about for food contact products. But it's all out there. Everything's been published in the scientific literature.
Well, Steve, then the other question I've got is that with people, some people concerned, and the science is ongoing, and it's great that there's so much science underway and that there's going to be more reports to be looking at. Like you said, perhaps by the end of this year, there'll be more reports. But in the meantime, some people are saying, well, let's just try a different product. Because while the verdict is still out in some people's mind or in others that don't see any problem at all with BPA, they're saying there are people that would like to buy a product that isn't BPA. What's the progress in other products being developed? Is your industry involved in developing some other products that might do the same thing that perhaps aren't BPA?
Well, certainly the chemical industry makes a whole range of different plastics and resins, and in some cases, in many cases, they compete with each other. And so what's happened with BPA, though, has been quite interesting. Because of all the controversy, some product manufacturers have decided to switch from polycarbonate or epoxy resins to other plastics or resins. And where that's been really why that's been really interesting is because what's become apparent in the last couple of years or so is that in contrast to BPA, where we have very extensive scientific information, we have a strong scientific basis to support safety, the alternatives may not be so well studied. And that recently has not gone unnoticed by those who have been critical of BPA. Some of those same critics are now asking questions about the safety of the alternatives, but there's not nearly so much data there to really support them. And this has been recognized by scientists. They see this as somewhat of an open field, so we're starting to see more research on alternatives. And even some government agencies are starting to take an interest because the questions are being asked, new data is being generated. So it's a very interesting and evolving area. So yes, some alternatives have been used in certain products, but it's not clear that that's a good choice or not.
Well, it's kind of disconcerting, I think, to the public if you look at that, because like you said, there's been over 20 years of extensive research and beyond that that you've been involved with BPA, and some of these alternatives that might be rushing to market somewhat of that another 20 years perhaps they're going to be studied as well. And there's been other kinds of issues in other industries where sometimes the replacement has issues that you hadn't even anticipated. So it's no wonder, Steve, that the average consumer gets perplexed, wondering what to believe and how to sort through all of this, because it's fairly complicated. They've gotten more and more mistrustful and unsure of what technology and chemistry and so forth. And it seems like that's a big challenge we're not going to solve with one podcast conversation. But I'm sure that your organization, your members, are also concerned, too, in building that image of trust and rebuilding the confidence in, you know, large companies producing good things for good people and trying to replace what suspicion might be out there. I don't know how I'm going to pull that into a question, but it just feels, Steve, like there is this broader issue of earning the trust and respect of the public that have gotten worried about things that they didn't major in chemistry themselves, but they're fearful and mistrustful of many institutions.
Well, you're right. That's not exactly a question, but we appreciate that view that people don't necessarily trust the industry. We have recognized that we're only one voice. So what my industry in particular has always tried to do for a long time is really get into the science. And to us, it's really an open book. We've sponsored a lot of research. All of that has been published in the peer-reviewed scientific literature. And we rely quite a bit on government agencies who don't have any stake in this at all. They don't make or sell BPA or polycarbonate. So we rely quite a bit on their views, which we want and understand to be based on science. In the future, we will continue down that approach. We will communicate based on the science, and we continue to sponsor research.
What do you find in this whole journey that you can feel good about?
Well, I guess you assume I am optimistic, and you're right, I am optimistic, and it really comes down to two things. One is safety. That's really a given. We have to have a product that we know is safe. And I feel very confident, very optimistic about that based on all of the data that we have. And again, pointing back to FDA's own research. So we know a lot about the safety of BPA. And I also know that we have materials, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins, that provide high performance. So we know that BPA is safe in those materials, and they're widely used because of performance for very good reasons. They work. And so those are things that give me a lot of reason to be optimistic. Those things aren't going to change anytime soon. Once we've nailed down safety, we have high-performing materials, that's something to feel pretty good about going forward.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate your taking the time to have this conversation with me today. I'm going to give you one more opportunity, though, to name those websites where people could go to find more information.
Well, our website is Facts About BPA, FactsAboutBPA.org, and that is aimed really at consumers. So that's not intended to be a detailed scientific site, but it's based on science. If you really want to get deep into the science, the government NIH-sponsored website is PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D, and I don't have the URL handy, but you can easily find that, P-U-B-M-E-D, and I think it'll probably be .gov, but it's easy to find, and you can search and find many thousands of studies in BPA, as well as on a lot of other things.
Well, Steve, I really appreciate it. We're speaking to Steve Henches, the Executive Director of the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group at the American Chemistry Council. Steve, thanks for having this conversation with us.
You're welcome, and thank you for inviting me.
If you like what you hear, go to farmtotabletalk.com and follow us on SoundCloud, Facebook, and Twitter, or go to iTunes to subscribe and give us a review and a rating.